Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Vanity Fair.
Hey. Sorry about the divorce.
It's not a divorce, Chief.
Whatever.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Hillary Busis.
And I'm Chris Murphy, and we're here to discuss part 5 of season 4 of HBO's True Detective Night Country.
Later, John Hawks, who plays Hank Pryor, is going to be stopping by to talk about his time in Ennis and the end of his time in Ennis.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
Ends with a bang.
but first, let's do a quick recap. Danvers and Navarro are desperate to get to the caves where Annie Kay was killed. The only person that can lead them there, heroin addict Otis Heiss.
You can help me get well.
I can't get you heroin. You know that.
Your time's up.
Danvers learns the mining company was funding Salal's research. When she goes to question them, she's told the case is closed.
Forensics came back. It was a weather event. Slab avalanche.
Dirt. Sudden and can move at 100 miles an hour.
An avalanche? Come on.
The mining company pays Hank to make Otis disappear, that's in quotes, but this soon goes south when he catches up with Otis at Danvers' house.
You should know something. I didn't kill Annie Kay, I just moved her body. Blood is blood, Peter. Remember that.
No!
With two dead bodies, a cover-up is afoot as Danvers and Navarro are off to the caves.
We can't fix this. This is too big.
Liz,
we can't
fix it.
Hank was sent here to stop us from finding where Annie died. We are this close. The storm will help cover our tracks. That's why we have to go right now.
So maybe we could start at the end, because I feel like that was the big dramatic part of the episode.
I mean, Chris, I feel like you deserve some props. You said from the beginning, John Hawks is not a good guy.
I knew it. And I honestly, I wish I hadn't walked back that he had nothing to do with it because he was so stupid. You can be dumb and also be evil and do bad things when other more evil people tell you. And Kate McKittrick, Miss Silver Sky, which we should have, did we know it was called Silver Sky? Because skies are not supposed to be silver. That's an evil name. It should be blue sky.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
The first clue.
So many clues everywhere.
Silver sky is ominous. It's bad gray weather.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way that Hank's arc functioned in this episode was interesting and sort of hallmark of the complicated way characters are drawn in the show. Like, we had this moment where his son is outside listening to his dad sing. He said he's never heard him sing before. So it's this kind of sad, humanizing moment where this man who clearly has money problems and his, you know, fake wife didn't show up and basically robbed him and all this stuff. And then as the episode goes, proceeds to do, like, horrible things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I liked the way that Hank kind of existed on this show as an example of someone who probably is not inherently a bad person, but was corrupted by this company and by this place.
I really, God, the scene when Hank is gonna pull the trigger on Liz Danvers, and Peter just, boom, takes him out.
Shortly after saying, like, hey, listen, I'm not a killer, I just moved the body.
Mm-hmm, which is like, that's not good. But I was so, maybe this is so 2024 pilt, but I was like, wow, Chosen Family is so strong. Peter is choosing Liz over his own dad. And
That or Oedipal vibes are too strong.
Well, that Mrs. Robinson.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
But I was like, wow, there is something to be said about choosing who you are aligned to and actively denying the evil of the world. I appreciate that. I was proud. I was weirdly proud of Peter in that moment.
Mm-hmm. And they did lay the groundwork earlier on about, like, what we see Hank hit his son very hard. And Leah says something like, he's an animal. And it's like, oh, so this has happened before. Yeah. Like, this is an ongoing thing. Maybe that could have been teased out a little bit more to kind of give that final standoff a bit more sort of emotional tension. Mm-hmm. But I still felt it.
Yeah, I mean, they have a kind of classic, complicated father-son relationship. Certainly seems as though maybe, you know, killing his father is the way that Peter kind of steps into his own manhood. Like, this is, like, the turning point for him, maybe. I don't know. Like, will he now be able to find a way to, like, keep his own family together? Mm-hmm. Like, has he tapped into some new reserve of strength that he could only kind of get through this, like, terrible, violent thing?
Yeah.
Which doesn't
can
really
he be the man
like,
of the house now?
Which doesn't really
house.
Feel like, it feels kind of in keeping with the old True Detective, like that kind of storyline, more so than in this like feminized, like less, it's not a show about masculinity anymore in the same way, but I guess.
About
this,
toxic masculinity.
Right, but his storyline does bring that previous thread more to the fore.
Yeah. It feels though to me that like if we ended at that and like that's sort of the end of any sort of interrogation of masculinity on the show, I'd be like, okay, that's fine, because it's not really about what the show. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, Peter and Hank were both major supporting characters. It's not really about them. So if it's like, if the ending is, you know, Peter made a decision, he has to choose once and for all, is it Liz or is it Hank? And he chooses Liz and he has to wrestle with that forever, then I feel satisfied with that. I will say, I was worried, given what we'd been saying about Evan Peters, that was the end of Peter.
Well, that's
I thought it was
that's
very
definitely,
much.
Yeah.
That was more telegraphed from the beginning. Like it seemed, you know, you can't be this like innocent, like kind of naive guy and like survive on the ice. But maybe you can if you murder somebody.
If you murder your own father and you sidle up with a strong woman.
Yes, those are the two requirements.
That's how you do it.
To survival. But yeah. So obviously, the entire episode is not just about Peter and Hank. But it's a great ending.
It really is.
This show knows how to do a final scene in
gosh.
An episode.
Hank, so pathetic, so pathetic. Can we talk a little bit about his admission that he moved Annie Kay? Because that was, I was a little bit like, whoa, like I like rewound for a second.
Were you surprised in the scene where he's talking to Kate or that kind of is like, kind of where we thought that storyline was going anyway?
I have to say, I sort of forgot Kate existed for a little bit. She makes an impression at the very beginning, right? And then we learn that Danvers fucked her husband, and that was like, go Danvers. And then for her to sort of emerge as like the big evil boss of the whole entire thing of the mine, it does make sense, but I think the show did a good job of distracting us from Kate to bring us back. I was surprised that Hank was in cahoots, but obviously to disseminate evil in the world, you gotta have friends, an evil cabal, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Hank's role in that was less surprising, I guess, but how he was used, moving Annie Kay's body, I was like, oh, that I didn't really expect. Because him keeping that secret for so long, I don't know, he just seems so dumb that, like, it feels like that would have come out at some point.
Conspicuously moving the files that incriminate you, I guess, is maybe sort of a rookie move, but it seems to have worked.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's also the question of Kate saying to Hank, like, they can't find that cave. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, to what end? Obviously, Danvers is convinced about this kind of, you know, numbers and like stats about like pollution and stuff, right? Like, but do we think that's it? Like, I don't know. I kind of, if that was just it, I think I'd be a little bit like, oh, you know, is that all there is? Mm-hmm. But
because it just seems so obvious.
Well, yeah, in a way, I guess. But I don't know. It is kind of at the same time dense and interesting that Kate has been interacting with Danvers this way, when it's like she knew, had this horrible secret. She at least knows something about how about Annie Kay's death, about this mysterious cave, like all this stuff, like that this mine is a lot more malevolent than one thinks. And maybe that's actually the malevolent spirit that people are kind of feeling in the town in a way. It's kind of made manifest. But yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of curious about like what Kate knows about the cave and what we're going to find out about this cave.
Yeah, I will say we should have the rot within Kate goes all the way down to her daughter, who left Leah at that protest when Leah needed her most, because Leah's dating Kate's daughter. Right? And when Leah's getting beat up for going to the protest and protesting the mines, Kate's daughter, Leah's girlfriend, just runs away and leaves her. And who saves her is Navarro, which was pretty sweet.
Yeah. And even though she's been beat up by a cop, like, Danvers still takes the kind of tough love approach to Leah, which I get, because she's like, she needs to see that there are consequences of this stuff. Look, I don't agree that someone should be, like, necessarily keeping their child away from, like, almost young adult away from, like, expressing political views or whatever, but like...
But it's dangerous.
It's clearly dangerous.
And when you know that people have been murdered for doing the exact same thing that your daughter is doing.
Right. Like,
you would maybe not want them. But there was an interesting... I think Navarro coming in to save Leah, it was kind of nice in keeping of, you know, a Native woman helping another Native woman, an Indigenous woman helping another Indigenous woman, like that sort of community within the grander scheme of Ennis. I mean, that seems to be a theme overall from, you know, Annie Kay and the birthing scene and whatnot of, you know, helping out your own.
Yeah.
And looking out for each other in that way.
And we've definitely seen with Danvers throughout the season that Pryor is sort of a surrogate son. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, Leah is Navarro's now surrogate sister because she's just lost her sister, you know, at the beginning of the episode. She's getting the ashes and then burying them out in the ice.
Yeah.
With Rose's help, which I thought was an interesting kind of idea that Rose is many things, and one of them is sort of like helping dead people be shepherded into, you know.
What can't Rose do?
I mean, honestly.
She can make a gorgeous spread for Christmas Eve, all for herself. She can literally bury the bodies.
Catch you a woman who can do both. And really, I was like, wow, I'm so happy that she, I guess the show is way more economic with its characters and its people than I would have expected, which is good storytelling in terms of Rose helping to bury the bodies and not just being this like witchy woman who tells a story and then disappears. You know, it feels like Kate coming back and being like bad gal, dangerous woman of them all running the mine. Everyone is sort of has a purpose that is seems to be leading to what might be a satisfying conclusion. I don't know. I feel like there's still a lot that sort of needs to be wrapped up that I'm like, I don't know. If
kind of a fascinating amount, actually.
There is, Well, like, we still don't really know what the deal is with Otis.
Right. Like, he gives us more information in this episode, certainly, but, like, still seems kind of shifty and, like, you know, the relationship between him and the scientists and all that stuff, like, it's a bit murky, I suppose. But, yeah, there's a lot to answer in finale.
And we're also supposed to trust that he just, like, is going to be honest about the cave. I mean, he's a heroin addict.
Right.
He's shooting up. Danvers brings him back to her house and is like, point to where it is on the map. I don't know. I was like, we might want a second opinion.
She doesn't have much else to go on.
That is true. But I was like, you're playing fast and loose here.
For sure. Man, there's a lot of spooky stuff in this episode. I feel like I can't get the image of the baby coffins out of my head. Very, very upsetting. Like, in a show that is not short on upsetting imagery, that's worse than the corpsicle.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, and just sitting there in this shed waiting for the ground to thaw.
Right, they can't move them yet.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, this show is certainly, it's an interesting survey of this community, but it's not at all a sort of like uplifting one. You know, I mean, this is about a very like hard place and a very difficult place. And I think that's probably one of the most striking examples of that for sure. Not that real communities in northern Alaska necessarily dealing with exactly this stuff. Yeah. But
I mean, you would hope not.
Yeah, I hope not. But it's, you know, it's an interestingly bleak portrait, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, before we see Peter kind of come into his own by shooting Hank also, we get to see him confront Danvers and kind of get the truth out of her. Or, well, not the entire truth, I guess, about the Wheeler case. We still are not entirely sure what happened there. We know that it was not a murder-suicide.
Right.
But we've been known that. Like, we've known that for quite some time.
From the very first flashback.
That wasn't really the reveal that
Who killed who is still up in the air.
Yeah.
But him like, finally getting to, did you know that Wheeler was left-handed?
I mean,
that's
the right question.
That's finally the right question. Yeah, you're seeing that he is taking her advice to heart, and he is becoming the truest detective.
He's still in the running to become America's truest detective.
The next top true detective.
But, you know, in that way, he's disillusioned by both of his parental figures in the same episode, and then has to make this choice. Like, I know that this woman that I idolize and, like, look up to career-wise, whatever, basically risked my entire marriage and family for she's been lying to me and is corrupt in at least one way. And I don't know how deeply involved she was, but like something's bad. And then she finds out so is his dad. Yeah, and then like gun in hand has to make a decision.
Well, yeah. And are you going to go for like your blood relative who moved a body that was certainly like killed for protesting the mine, or kill your surrogate mother who also did bad things, maybe with better intentions, maybe more right. of a Robin Hood situation.
Yeah. I think ultimately it was easier to trust that Liz had slightly better intentions or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wait, can we talk about, okay, Hillary, you mentioned a deus ex machina, you know, mm-hmm. and whether or not that's really happened yet. I gotta say, when that random man is like, I know what the spirals mean, that was a little convenient. That was a little, and I love that her boyfriend, like, was useful and helpful, and it shows that not all men are terrible and yeah. whatnot, but when this random guy we've never seen before was like, well, obviously the spirals mean that that's where you fall through the ice, and mm-hmm. I was like, oh. Yeah.
It was giving a little, he knew my mother when she was researching spiders right before she died, yeah. like, it's that kind
Madam
of like,
Webb.
That's a lot of exposition.
That is a real deep cut from a movie trailer.
Well, so,
the girls will get it. We'll get
it's
it.
It's iconic.
That's true.
But yeah, I know what you mean, Chris, because I thought the use of the symbol, you know, True Detective past seasons have done this too. They have these kind of symbols and like, actually specifically this symbol, right?
Yeah. This is a recurring theme.
Yeah. And I just feel like it's always so ominously teased out. And I guess we still don't know what it means in a grander, more metaphysical way, mm-hmm. but its use, at least in this part of the world or whatever, is to warn people about imminent physical danger, which I think is like, you know, and obviously then it's being used to warn people in other ways and whatever, mm-hmm. but like, yeah, it was a little bit like I wanted there to be some kind of like, I don't know, evocative little mini monologue about it from someone or whatever, you know, I mm-hmm. wanted some like wise older person to sort of like hold forth on it.
I bet Fiona Shaw knew the whole time. Yeah. She just didn't want to
right,
tell.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Because you weren't ready.
Yeah.
You know Rose knew. Well, I mean, it is, if you look at it, a flat circle. And that is definitely something that is a theme on the show
for a
long, long time.
All circles are flat. Wow. If it is not flat, it is a sphere. Learned that in geometry.
My brain
in
just exploded. My brains are all over the table because my head exploded.
Nick Pizzolatto, I have a bone to pick with your central allegory.
The central theme.
But anyway, okay, so this is our penultimate episode. The wheels are in motion. We are headed to the ice caves. Obviously, nothing good is going to happen there. There is recurring mention of people falling through the ice that keeps on. That is a motif that is coming up. It almost happens to Navarro. We hear that it happened to Peter when he was a kid. Like, there is, you know, someone's fallen into the water. These things are not an accident. Do you think going into this final episode, our heroes are going to make it out alive?
I don't know, because I feel like we have a trio, right? Like, mm-hmm. like Pryor's a little bit lower on the total, you know, like
he's kind of been inducted,
scale,
though,
but like,
yeah.
But like he's pulled that trigger, you know, yeah. And now he's
it's a hell of a hazing.
He's going to Rose to like help fix this problem, right? Like, does he like become a further victim of this or whatever? Mm-hmm. I don't know if Navarro goes because she's already lost a sister. Maybe she kind of goes to be with her sister,
yeah.
and that's kind
I mean,
of
she
the
keeps
sad
getting
poetic
dragged
end.
Out
she's
into
still,
the,
she's not in a good place. She's, no, yeah. clearly.
Well, she's like, yeah, the same thing's coming for me or calling yeah. to me or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she does have Kwavik, like she does have someone in her life, and she's getting closer to Danvers. But like, I don't know. Maybe this show is bleak enough to say like she had no hope. Yeah. But or Danvers dies a saber. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean it's HBO, so it's hard to believe that all three will make it out alive.
Right.
You know, it's a mini-series.
Yeah.
It feels like someone is going, and they all have blood on their hands, mm-hmm. literally. Peter and his dad and Danvers and Navarro mm-hmm. with Wheeler. Not saying that he didn't deserve it, but they all
Although
have
we don't know if, you know, did they shoot him at the same time?
Yeah, we don't like, know who shot him. And also, we still don't even know exactly what happened to Danvers' son, to Hudson.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. No. Hayden.
What's his name?
Holden. I love you guys just naming Brooklyn children.
100%.
Hudson, Holden.
I hope that all stays in this episode. But so they all have something to sort of atone for. So, and not that you should pay for your crimes, but it would be in keeping with HBO shows and I think the series if one of them, you know, gave the ultimate sacrifice for.
No, Navarro dying feels too bleak. Danvers dying to save Navarro is maybe predictable, but I could see it happening.
Yeah. And then we should remind ourselves that I know it's a different writer, but like Harrelson and McConaughey both survived.
It's true.
The first season. And I was convinced that one of them was, I guess I had to assume it was Woody Harrelson because, well, McConaughey's like kind of narrating it from the future.
Right.
But like, Taylor Kitsch gets killed in the second season of True Detective.
Mahershala Ali just kind of descends into dementia.
We're
ruining all. I mean, I assume if you've gotten this far, you've probably seen True Detective before now. So
I mean, definitely don't feel worried about being spoiled about season 2. Seriously.
Oh, what's Colin Farrell has like a son with like a funny name.
Oh God,
I can't remember.
Is it Holden Hayden?
Holden Hayden Hudson. Yeah, that's his name. Yeah.
But that's a good question. I mean, I guess we should really start thinking about like where this is all headed. And I think another death is probably in the offing. I wonder how many people we're going to get in those ice. Like, this would be way too cheesy for the show, but like McKittrick and Danvers pointing pistols at each other in an ice cave.
That would be.
This ends here, like that kind of
that's
moment.
That's kind of fun. Well, I mean, we're still looking for Clark, right?
Well, yeah, that's true.
We don't know where he is.
And it's interesting that like we still don't know Clark-wise, like, how involved he, like we've seen one picture of a good relationship, another picture of someone who's like stolen away into the snow.
We know that Salal is fudging pollution numbers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're murdering anybody.
Right, because he could have been the whistleblower or he was the chief perpetrator. Like it could go either way, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I think we're all saying like there's still a lot to be answered in 1 hour of television.
It was Chad, by the way. Chad is calling for
help. Oh, that's good.
That's basically Holden.
Yeah, and his daughter was Stacy.
I can't top that.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment, and when we return, a conversation with John Hawkes, who plays Hank Pryor.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Not a great day to be Hank Pryor. Not a great life to have, I think.
No, I don't think so.
Hank Pryorly, he was alive.
But I'm ching.
Yes, I'm here all week. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack with Hank. To get killed by your own son is a real doozy.
In cold blood? Is it in cold blood because it was cold?
Yeah. Yeah. But he has a nice, I mean, it's not clean at the end, but it's like a nice good arc of a character to play.
For sure.
And what an actor, John Hawkes, to play that character. He's great. He's been great in everything he's been in, you know, for many, many years, which is why it was especially exciting that we got a chance to talk to him about his role, about
his mail order bride.
Whether he's still waiting for her.
Right.
Whether she took the flight.
Yeah. Just basically all things Hank. So enjoy that conversation with John Hawkes.
John, thank you so much for joining us to say goodbye to Hank Pryor, I guess.
Thank you.
So yeah, we want to talk all about your last scene in this episode and kind of everything leading up to it. But first, we were really excited to see that you also sing a song in this episode that Hank kind of scores this really tense moment that erupts into a riot at the mine. And I understand that you wrote the song as well, right?
I did, yes.
How did it wind up in the episode? Can you tell us kind of the story of that?
Sure. When I was first meeting the director and creator, Issa Lopez, via, I guess, video chat, we were talking about the character, and she mentioned the idea that she might want Hank to play music. And I balked briefly, just feeling like, well, if Hank was a creative person, an artist of sorts, he wouldn't be the screwed up guy he is, maybe. Maybe he'd be a different person. But it's a great disservice actors do themselves when they say, my character wouldn't do that. Because we're all mysteries to ourselves, I think. We surprise ourselves with our behavior often. I was looking to make Hank a more subtle, rounded, complex person from what I'd first read anyway, and that seemed like another way to maybe accomplish that. So when I came around to the idea that Hank played guitar and he'd been in a band, many years ago as a young guy, I thought, cool, I'll write a score piece. And I did, and sent it to Issa, and she loved it, and that was fine. And we were in Reykjavik beginning to shoot, and at one point I had a gig playing music in Reykjavik, and Issa came. And afterwards she said, well, you got to sing, you got to write some words. And I can't say argue, because Issa and I, and I'm sure the other actors would concur, she's just an incredible person to work with. It wasn't like it was real arguing, but it was good-natured bickering for a few weeks with my saying, well, it's going to become performative suddenly. It's going to be a guy in his living room performing, it felt like, if I start singing. And I'd always just seen it as a score piece. And eventually I came around, and Sue Jacobs, who brought a lot of the music to the show, is amazing. She and Issa both agreed there needed to be words. So I wrote words and a melody kind of at the last minute, and that was that. I'm glad it did. It serves really well.
And when you were writing the lyrics to the song, were you doing it in character?
I was. I believe I was. There is no love, no lost, and unfound.
Yeah, it's pretty bleak.
It is. And even a line I wrote later in the song that says, there is no place to get unwound, is kind of happening while the whole riot is happening. It ended up one of those lucky things, serving really well. And Vince Pope, who scores the show, did what I always hoped and dreamed would happen, which was the song starts with a guy and a guitar and becomes a more orchestrated piece as it goes along. So
there is no king, he won't be crowned.
I saw it for the first time last night to kind of catch up to speak to you. I got the episodes late, but I was really, really happy with how things rolled out around the song.
Yeah, it's a really powerful, evocative, and sort of mysterious moment in a way, because we are seeing this other side of this guy who could easily have been just a standard issue villain in the murder mystery,
Yes.
And obviously if you're involved, John Hawkes, the actor, is involved, it's going to be more interesting than just that standard issue thing. So I'm curious what conversations you and Issa had about Hank. Did you come up with backstory or how did you figure out how to shade him so interestingly?
When Issa and I first began to meet, I hadn't worked in a long time, honestly. And through COVID, and I knew that I wasn't a lead character in the show, which would be fine, except that I knew that I'd be in Iceland where it would be cold and very dark for a long time, playing this very dark character. And pretending to be this guy every day was both a kind of privilege and a burden. These characters, yeah, just pretending, so I'm just reading the script every day, it's heavy. And I was a little worried about that. And Issa spoke to Jody, and Jody said, I'll make him laugh. Tell him I understand, and I'll make him laugh every day on set. And I thought that was really beautiful, long before I'd met Jody, for her to say that. My other real concern with Hank was that Issa's an incredible writer, but I felt like Hank was pretty one-dimensional. And I thought that we could serve the story a lot more by bringing more notes to him, more levels, more layers, to not just be kind of a one-note male chauvinist pig, but to find a kind of humanity in this person and a more complex human being. So we worked toward that. As far as backstory, that's something I do always in great detail. I'm an over-preparer who likes to know too much and then try to forget everything when the curtain goes up or the director says action, and just be present with the other actors and try to serve that moment. as best I can. But the cool thing about this was that Issa actually worked with me creating the backstory. You know, we'd never met, but we were, as I said, talking on video chat for several sessions leading up to my arriving in Reykjavik. But I realized quickly that I had to be careful what I said, because I was just kind of throwing out ideas, and then she'd send me a draft and some of those ideas were in there. And I was like, I have to be careful what I say, because it will go right in, which is really cool. She was so open to it and also had a lot of suggestions herself. So yeah, I made a lengthy kind of a backstory about Hank that Issa, you know, also had something to do with, for sure.
One of the other forlorn moments for Hank is he's met this woman online and he has made plans to bring her to Alaska and to start a life with her. And then that doesn't pan out. And I think we're meant to assume that maybe there was some sort of financial scam involved. And and what I loved about how you played it, John, was that he doesn't react in immediate anger or even very visible sadness. He kind of just says, well, okay, or she probably, there was something going on with her mom, you know, it's probably fine. What were those decisions like in kind of calibrating that moment? Because when, you know, he's telling his son about it and he's kind of almost cheery in a weird way about it. Because I just think it's such a fascinating, almost like it goes against what we expect to happen.
Thank you for seeing that. I always do try to play against the unexpected. When things are written really strongly as an actor, you can often play against them, I think, with good result. Again, seeing it last night, it's so wonderful to see how editors work, because the scene had a lot. As written, you know more than you do in the current version. But I think that's pretty wonderful, too. I would tell you that while Hank is standing at the airport and the plane's door goes up and no more passengers are coming off, and he realizes she's not on the plane, he quickly texts her. This is not in the show. He texts her and basically said, you know, this number's, you're blocked, basically. And so he's definitely been scammed. Another thing I love to do as an actor is figure out the truth of a character and then pile on all kinds of layers on top of that and let the truth just peek through now and then. So the obvious answer would be for Hank to throw his phone on the ground and throw the teddy bear across the runway. But there was a clue, and this scene was actually rewritten long before we shot, but I liked what was said between my son and Isabella Starr LeBlanc's character, who plays Jody's stepdaughter. Those two were talking, and Peter Pryor, my son, was describing Hank as just the toughest person he's ever known, and that whatever comes, he just takes it. And so even though that left the script, I did cleave to that a bit. So it provides an opportunity for Hank to kind of, again, provide a cover to what's really going on underneath. And I think that's fun to watch as an audience. So he definitely knows he's been scammed. He did send her a lot of money. And all he knows is to try to keep going forward somehow. And in that case, he reaches out to his son to try to find some kind of consolation, some kind of solace in joining his son and his family for Christmas. And of course, that doesn't work out in the end either.
Yeah, Hank and Peter have a very complicated relationship. I mean, especially with the ending of the episode, like it seems very kind of overtly Oedipal in the way that things shake out. But yeah, can you tell us a little bit about navigating with Finn Bennett, kind of what Hank and Peter are to each other? You know, there's kind of a level of abuse, there's a level of love, there's all sorts of complicated emotions.
For sure. First, Finn is just extraordinary in the show, as everyone is, but it's been especially fun to see him. Yeah, it was fun to watch his work come together. He and I spent a lot of time together hanging out, getting to know each other, laughing. I loaned him a guitar for a while because he was interested in that. I think that it's such an interesting relationship between the two of them. Issa was saying that his hitting his son is a form of love almost as well. Hank isn't very good at expressing the love he has for his son and the desperate need he has to be close to his son. And the show is about, Issa told me early on, about partly about loneliness. And I thought that Hank would be an ideal character amongst many others to kind of illustrate that. So he's got this kid and he's losing him to Danvers, to Jodie Foster's character. You know, we didn't talk a ton about feelings or why we felt. It was more just trying to figure out what would serve each scene the best as far as how we related to each other.
Hank says this thing to Kate McKittrick, the head of the mine. You know, he's willing to do some bad things for her, move a body here and there, but he's not a killer. And then the arc of this episode takes him pretty close to that threshold. What do you think the turn is for Hank? Like, is it just desperation? Do you think he really was going to pull that trigger?
You know, it's interesting. We rehearsed for about 2 weeks, which was a really great luxury for Kaylee Reese, Jodie Foster, Finn Bennett, Isabella. We would, along with Issa, take hours each day and just go through each scene and work on it and decide if a line rang false, maybe something else could be written. And we got a lot of work done, but that last scene in episode 5, we couldn't get there with it. It really strained credibility. It went around a lot of different ways. And so finally, some Saturday or Sunday, we met at Issa's apartment in Reykjavik, and Jodie, Kaylee, Finn, and myself, along with Issa, just took hours with that scene and rewrote it and got it into a place pretty much right before we shot that we were all happy with.
Was the ending always that Peter was going to shoot Hank, or was that also something that changed?
Yes, there were different versions of that. But yes, that was always going to happen in some way. We didn't want the typical standoff where everyone's pointing their weapons at each other. We wanted, again, something that would be motivated, believable, and really serve the moment. I think we got there. I think Hank's shooting Otis is instinct. It's not something he'd hoped to do. I improvised to Jodie walking over to the body, Jesus Christ, like, kind of, why did you do this? We didn't have to do it this way, I guess. It was the feeling I was trying to convey to her and my true horror and regret at what had just gone down. I think Hank fools himself a lot with Alina, his fiance that doesn't exist, with a relationship with his son that doesn't really exist. And in this case, I think Hank had to see some way that it would all work out in the end if he could just get Otis and get him out of there. Not only would he become chief of police, but Kate McKittrick, who owns the mine and basically owns the town, she's got a lot on him. And so he's really at her beck and call. So he's got to do it. But I think that he's visualized a way that didn't involve killing Otis and getting himself killed in the end, I suppose. But when his son will not choose him and chooses Danvers over him, he doesn't have anything left. He's lost his love, his work, and now his family.
There's so much emotional at play in that sequence. It's really striking. But I'm always also curious about the sort of technical onset of it all. I mean, you know your character is about to die. Does that create a very different mood on set? And with gunplay and blood and bullets and all that stuff, what are the challenges there, technically speaking?
Wow. I think it was a different mood. Finn and I had spoken this morning, and it was a scene that he didn't dread, but he basically mentally circled as this is a really important thing, and all the lead up to it, I think he felt, and the pressure of it. One of my first meetings with Issa, once I learned Hank would meet his end, I I said, I'm not interested in being part of this if it's glorified, if it's slow motion, if it's just too graphic. I'm not afraid of dark material, but I'm kind of tired of a certain kind of violence. And she assured me that it wouldn't be glorified or beautiful somehow, is being shot. Yeah, it's kind of like a lot of the logistics are who's pointing at who, where, when is the decision made, what might be said by Hank after the decision is made. I, you know, suggested basically saying I didn't kill Annie Kay, I just moved her body. Issa thought that blood is blood, Peter, remember that, to harken back to, I think, episode 2 would be a great idea. I thought that was wonderful. So, yeah, it's a lot of, I mean, there were things that we didn't even find until that day I came into rehearsal. And there was a new wrinkle with the idea of, well, why wouldn't Jody be able to defend herself or fire back? And it was decided that she would, in the comfort of her home, take her sidearm off and lay it on the table. And so we had to kind of dance that dance quickly and figure out how to make that all work well, and it did. So, yeah, it's a jumble of answers, but it's a complicated thing to do. We didn't have a ton of time to do it. I think we did it well. And hopefully it's subtle and yet still has a lot of charge to it.
Yeah, so. I think you really avoided any glorifying. I think it's just blunt and terrible, like as it would be in real life.
Yeah, it doesn't seem triumphant at all. It's not like this is, mm-hmm. you know, we took down the bad guy.
Yeah, and even beyond that is just the literal cinematography of the violence of it. And I'm just glad that it was just kind of fast and shocking.
Was that your final day of shooting on the series?
No, but it was near the end. You know, the guitar, all that stuff happened for me kind of the last week. You know, after 6 months of being there, I did most of the stuff I did really in the last probably week that I was in Reykjavik, partly because I'd gotten COVID right before Christmas and all those scenes had to be moved. And so they were moved to the end.
When you watch a mystery show like this as a casual viewer, are you kind of picking apart little clues? And, you know, in the opening credits alone for this season of True Detective, there feels like there's lots of little Easter eggs and stuff. Is that how viewers should be watching this? And or is that how you would watch it if you were not a part of the show?
I think so. I like a mystery quite a lot. And I think it's a very human thing to want to solve a puzzle. And I haven't seen the last episode, so luckily I have no spoilers on that, but I won't blurt out something wrong. But but I do know that in any good story, as in life, there's no neat bow, I don't think, tied around things. I think that there's hopefully a really satisfying conclusion, but one that still has questions. Because for me, I'm not too interested in art answering questions so much as asking them, I suppose.
But do you? You do know what happens in the final episode, even?
I do,
even,
yeah.
You haven't watched it?
Yeah.
Were you surprised to find out on paper, you know, what happened to the Solal scientists in as much as the show?
Yes, of course,
it? Yes.
You know, it was, you know, a good script is like a really good novel, you know, when it's done right. It's page turning and you're praying that it doesn't let you down at the end. When I was first reading the script, I think all I got was the first script before Issa and I met. And when I read it, I was floored. She's such a good writer. And I said, I can't wait to see what happens. And she says, me too, because she hadn't written the rest of it at that time. So she just written this episode and then had to figure out how to make it have a beginning, middle, and an end, and have a satisfying conclusion. But
well, we won't make you risk any more spoilers. Don't worry.
Thank you.
You know, it might be somewhat hard to mourn for Hank himself, but we will miss your performance. Definitely added a crucial texture to the show. And we're really glad that you could talk with us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it was so nice to talk to you both. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. It must feel, after spending so much time making something and then having to keep everything secret for a long time, being able to be out in the open about it must be nice.
Thank you for letting me, kind of relieve a little of the burden that I carry.
Happy NDA lift
the
day.
That's right.
All right. Well, thanks again, John.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. When we return, we are going to make our final predictions on who done it.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
We are almost at the end. We have one more episode to go, which means it is time for our final predictions of who done it. To refresh you, the winner, who's closest to kind of deemed, I guess, by the others, we're going to buy them an icy or a Slurpee. There's been some debate about
nomenclature.
We've had predictions all season long, ranging from a polar bear to mysterious gases seeping out of the earth and actually people. So I guess now, Hillary and Chris and myself too, what are our final predictions? And is it a new one or are you going back to an old one you've already made?
Okay, I'll start because I'm looking back at my expert, incredible predictions. The polar bear, the ghost of Julia, Oliver Tagok, remember him? Will we see him again?
Yeah. No, he's
probably not. Okay, I'm going to let him go. And I'm going to go add on to my first prediction of Hank, right? Annie K. We learned that Hank said that he moved the body. And I don't think the last line that Hank will ever say on the show is a lie. I think I trust that he was involved. He moved the body. I think we heard a lot about Connolly, and we barely saw him this episode, right? Connolly's in cahoots with Kate. Clearly knows about the mine.
This does go all the way to the top.
So it goes all the way to the top.
He's running for some sort of office, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he's political. He's running for office. She's making a mess of the mines and the town. I think that I'm going to say that Connolly killed Annie Kay, got Hank to move the body.
Yeah.
And then things got messed up and then moved Jodie Foster over there and she became chief of police and took Hank's spot. And the Hank hates Connolly because of that.
Okay. So is Connolly involved with the scientist murder? Because it's officially not a murder.
Avalanche.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, we could just blame the avalanche as Kate does.
Which is what they blamed for the Russians.
I thought that's a fun Easter egg. And definitely Issa Lopez being like, this is bullshit.
Yeah, totally.
You know what? You know who we haven't seen in a long time? I don't think it's Connolly.
Travis Cole.
Travis Cole. No, I'm going to say it's Annie's brother. Remember him?
Oh yeah.
Remember him?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. He was on our list. Yeah,
maybe he thinks the scientist did it and he went and got revenge or something.
Yeah,
like
revenge.
That.
Maybe he teamed up with Kwavik. Maybe they teamed up and they.
So are there good men? So, that would be sort of thematic. Yeah.
That would be. There's not one to be seen if that's the case. So yeah, I'm gonna go with Annie's brother teaming up with Kwavik, slaying some Salals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about you, Hillary?
How about me? So Kate must have known about Annie Kay getting murdered, right?
That's why you can't go to the caves.
Yeah.
She can't find the cave.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Like, I think Kate knows about everything that happens in the town.
Yeah, so I don't think she did not commit the murder. She did not cut out any tongues herself, like not her style, but she caused it to happen, Annie Kay.
Okay.
I'm going to say.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that I think that I'm keeping my prediction where it was from the last episode. But when it comes to the scientists, like somebody finding out about Annie Kay and then going after the scientist, like I do feel like that kind of there has to be a reason that these two things are connected. Like her tongue being at Salal, it's not an accident.
Yeah, it's not purely about the mine,
right?
Yeah.
And so I mean, what you just said, Chris. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to go with Annie Kay's brother and Kwavik, but like maybe Fiona Shaw has like a cabal of like old witches that she like rides into battle with and they are the ones.
Oh yeah, and she does have that ice pick. And isn't the first time we see Fiona Shaw, isn't she like skinning something?
Yeah.
She's skinning an animal.
So I could see that being an early breadcrumb leading to a conclusion such as that. Mm.
Okay, I still am going with the theory that something is seeping out of the earth driving people insane because we have like eyes scratched out and stuff like that. So I now
That's true. They're not just killed. They are like horrified and
I think that Clark and Annie were fooling around in this cave. Something killed Annie, like some sort of chemical or whatever, or like gas or whatever. Kate had it covered up to look like just a kind of random murder because she trusted that no one investigates these murders.
And she didn't want anything. She didn't want, like, her prized, like, lab to be in jeopardy.
And then years later, the same stupid thing happened to the scientists where they dug too deep and went crazy and then ran out into the snow. So I think the killer is the environment.
Are you satisfied
if it's... what about Sorry.
I think that she died from this same thing that was being released
and then it was covered up.
They didn't want to know.
And that's why
they staged
wounds.
It like a murder.
Okay,
But if the answer is M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, is that a satisfying answer?
No, unless Danvers does battle with Mother Nature herself.
Well, Mother Nature could be by the polar bear. And so then it's the polar bear. And then I'm right.
The whole polar bear stands on its hind legs and speaks.
And it has like a weird deep voice.
Exactly.
Whispers. She's the one who's awake.
The polar bear all comes back to the polar bear.
Well, we're going to find out next week. I'm very excited. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Christris.
And I'm there at Hillabuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Steven Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for the finale to True Detective Night Country. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
From PRX.